and welcome to another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Dr. Z, Dr. Eugene Zampron, naturopathic physician and herbalist with the American Herbalist Guild. And we're so happy to that you took some of your time to tune in and listen in to Progressive Radio Network and the program. You can always get more information on either myself or The Natural Nurse at our respective websites. That's naturalnurse.com and drznaturally.com. Find out about what we're doing and our fun shops and our host of other projects. So we have an interesting guest. We have botanist Judith Sumner, and Judith specializes in ethnobotany, flowering plants, garden history. She's taught at different botanical gardens throughout the world, including the Arnold Arboretum of Harvard University and the Garden of the Woods, which is the foremost native plant garden of New York. She graduated from Vassar and completed graduate studies in systemic botany at UMass at Amherst. She studied at the Royal Botanic Gardens at Kew and the British Museum of Natural History, and did a lot of work in the Pacific region on the genus Pittosporum. She's published monographs, and particularly today, we're going to be talking about Plants Go to War, A Botanical History of World War II, which is a look at military history from a botanical perspective, from victory gardens to agriculture to rubber, coal, paper, timber, drugs, which I want to talk a little bit about quinine with Judith maybe, and a look at military history from a botanical perspective. So I'm really excited to have her on there. How you doing, Judith? Welcome.
Good morning, Dr. Z. I'm glad to be on your show this morning.
Yes, thanks for taking the time. I really appreciate it. So let's talk a little bit about how you got interested in botany. We all seem to love plants and at different levels. And not only loving plants, but actually working with them and communicating them and understanding their history. Just an aside, I teach medical history at the College of Naturopathic Medicine at the University of Bridgeport, so I'm a big history aficionado, too.
Uh-huh.
My father has a degree in history, a high-level degree in history, and I remember as a kid him kind of keeping me spellbound by kind of presenting history not as a boring old professor, but almost like a engrossing human story. And that's, I think, how he got me hooked as a kid. How'd you get interested?
Well, you know, just before we move on to botany, I'll add one little anecdote.
Sure.
About history. Richard Evan Schultes, who taught for many years at Harvard, he's considered really the father of ethnobotany.
Mm-hmm.
He often commented that we should have the botanists of the world writing history, because so much history involves human interaction with plants.
Wow.
And I always thought that was an interesting comment.
I love it. I love it.
Yeah. But I'll tell you how I got interested in botany, and it actually has to do with polio.
Mm.
My late mother had polio, and her brother had polio. They grew up in New York City on the Grand Concourse in the Bronx at a time when obviously there were not immunizations. And in the summer of 1926, they both came down with polio at the end of the summer, and they were not seriously affected. Mother had no symptoms until late in life, and she had some muscle pain, and my uncle had only a minor problem with one of his eyelids, of all things.
Wow.
But my mother was terrified of polio, and when I was a child, a young child, there were not immunizations, and so she would listen to the radio every spring. And as soon as she heard the first case of polio anywhere up and down the eastern seaboard, she would just pull me out of school. I would be done. Some years I was done in March. Some years I was done in May.
Wow.
And then I just became a free-range child. And, you know, my heart goes out to these kids today whose parents won't let them out of the backyard. And the backyard is manicured grass and mulch, and there's nothing to see out there besides mulch and grass, because I was liberated. I taught myself We lived on a bluff above a lake. And I was allowed, from age three, you didn't just go out and do what you want to do. Just show up for supper. I would let myself down the bluff. There were farms down there. There were the remnants of colonial herb gardens, believe it or not, because this was just west of Boston, in one of the old towns, a town where Paul Revere rode through.
Yeah.
And so there were still herbs growing as roadside plants that had escaped from colonial herb gardens. I didn't know it at the time, but I remember as a little child looking at tansy and chicory and Queen Anne's lace and self-heal and gill over the ground and smelling them and nibbling them. And that is how I became a botanist, just going out and seeing plants and learning about plants. Because I missed, the last couple of months of school for years on end.
Wow.
And it was a gift. It was just marvelous.
That's kind of how you were immersed in it and got interesting.
And then
we
had a neighbor.
Well, it's interesting what we talked about the war and our subject today because, a lot of what my father taught me was, he's Italian, my father, so he's from Venice, around Venice, and the area that he was at was being heavily bombed with the Allies, so he was shuttled from grandparent to grandparent to great-aunt and trying to keep the kids alive. And so this is where he was immersed in the farms and the gardens that the old Italians had, and my great-grandparents. And he would tell me very interesting stories about the gardening, but you're coming at the discussion that the war actually sort of helped us make medicines, helped us discover that plants were valuable for helping out not only with the war effort but with tangential things, health, wellness, things like that. So why don't you delve into that whole interesting subject?
Well, when I started this project, and we're tentatively titled the book Plants Go to War, A Botanical History of World War II, and I don't think it'll be out for another couple of years. I'm actually still writing. It's about two-thirds written.
Okay.
But my goal, Dr. Z, is to look at the war from the perspective of a botanist and look at every possible way that plants were involved. And so, obviously, victory gardens, agriculture, but then also rubber, coal. Coal is actually fossilized plant material, as is natural gas. Paper, timber, fibers. Just think about the demand for cotton fibers in the war, because the vast majority of uniforms were made from cotton. All sorts of other plant products. Agar was very important. And then, for instance, something like camouflage. Landscape painters had to learn how to paint vegetation so that it looked realistic from a distance. And that was something else that really moved forward during the war.
Hmm.
Now, of course, the story of medicinal plants during the war is particularly interesting from the viewpoint of the English. So, of course, the English were involved in the war long before we were. They declared war on Germany back in 1939.
Right.
After Germany invaded Poland. And so they were at war with Germany for a couple of years before we got involved. The English got themselves into a real box with regard to both food and medicine. They were importing about two-thirds of their food. And a lot of their vitamin-rich foods, like citrus, were coming from abroad. Mm. The English soils were really played out. They had practiced agriculture since pre-literate times in England without the benefit of knowledge of crop rotation and, enriching the soil. And so their soil was just pooped.
Right.
And so it was so easy for them to import fruits and vegetables from Europe and even seeds. They were even getting their seed stock from Holland. The other major commodity that they were getting from Holland, and this was another huge strategic error, of course it's easy for us to look back with 2020 hindsight, but we'll just remark on it now, was that they were getting virtually all of their prescription drugs, their pharmaceutical medicines, were coming from Holland. Once the Germans occupied Holland, obviously they were not going to send any pharmaceutical drugs to England. The few pharmaceutical drugs that England could get its hands on, they were sending off to the troops. So what this meant was the folks at home had no drugs.
Mm.
Go to the local chemist, which is their equivalent of a pharmacy in the U.S., nothing. There was simply nothing there. Now, fortunately, in England, we have one of the foremost botanical gardens and research institutions in the world. It's the Royal Botanic Gardens at Kew, just outside of London. I imagine many of your visitors have been there. It's just a short ride on the district line from downtown London. So at Kew, there are marvelous gardens, but there are also research botanists. Botanists got together with the War Department, and they came up with a scheme, which they called the Vegetable Drugs Committee.
Wow.
They sat down, committee of botanists, and said, what do we know are efficacious herbal drugs? So they basically went back to square one. What was used during the Middle Ages? What do we know actually works? We'll just have to go out. We will gather it county by county, because there are different, you know, ecosystems in England, ecotypes and this sort of thing. And so they went county by county, and they actually published manuals, little paperback pamphlets that were collection manuals by county. And they mobilized anyone who was at home. So this would have been homemakers, housewives, the elderly, the old age pensioners, the Girl Guides, the Boy Scouts, anybody who could get up and get out and go especially down the country roads to what in England are known as the hedgerows. Hedgerows are natural fences which are very, very biodiverse. It's a lot of shrubs, not one species, many shrubs planted in lines that originally were designed to demarcate agricultural fields. So there would be a hedgerow between you and your neighbor. Hedgerows have their own ecology, and many plants continually self-seed and grow in these hedgerows, and that happens to be the most biodiverse habitat where you're going to find many of these medicinal plants. And so they just went out and they collected. The big challenge was getting the plant material dry, because if you collect herbs and you just leave them, you know, in a bag for a couple of days, you'll start getting microbial activity that will not only spoil the appearance of the herb and, you know, turn it dark and maybe even slimy, but will actually change the medical constituents of the plant. You don't want that. Mm. So the manuals talked about, you know, go in your linen closets or go into a room that has old lace curtains and take them down and get some wooden strips and build a frame and tack the old lace curtains, and now you have a drying rack. And if you have a small outbuilding and you can make a little fire, a coal fire or a coke fire, get that little building hot and bring these racks filled with the collected herbs out there and dry them. So here are some of the plants they actually collected.
In the hedgerow, in other words, plants growing in that hedgerow and other areas.
These are some of the hedgerow plants that they collected that people will remember. They collected a burdock.
Mm.
And burdock is across Eurasia and into England, and it has a number of medicinal uses. And so they went back, and burdock is a diuretic, and it seems to stimulate immune response, and so they used burdock. They collected valerian.
Mm-hmm.
Valerian allays tension. And if you are upset, valerian will calm you down. And
right.
They collected valerian. We'll come back to valerian. I want to say a little bit more about that in a minute. They collected the original cure for the edema associated with congestive heart failure, which is potentially quite dangerous. It's foxglove. And it contains the cardiac glycosides, digitalis and digitoxin and all of those. Now, you can overdose on that. You can overregulate your heart. And so that had to be dealt with, you know, very carefully. Now, these medicines, when they were, or these medicinal plants, I should say, when they were collected and dried, they were brought to central depots, and then they were shipped to drug companies. So these actually went into sort of the drug chain. People were not necessarily brewing up herbal teas at home, but these now were coming in through the chemist shops, and the physicians were sort of having to go back and recall their knowledge of medicinal herbs and prescribe from there. And so it was quite a time. It was quite a time. And, I mean, we can only imagine what something like that would be. I want to say a little bit more about valerian. As we all know, England was bombed extensively during the war. And you go to any of the big cities, and you know, large parts of them were destroyed. England, the Midlands, Liverpool, a lot of rebuilding had to occur after the war. Now, what did people do? People who lived in cities had to shelter. Many of the children were shipped out. They were shipped to the countryside. And they spent the war as evacuees. But most of the adults stayed home in the cities. And there were different sheltering options. One actually involved building a shelter in your garden. And these were known as Anderson shelters. An Anderson shelter consisted of several pieces of corrugated metal. The top pieces, when you put them together, made a, sort of a dome, a curve, almost like a Quonset hut, a miniature Quonset hut. But that's not what protected you. What protected you was the excavated soil from around the installation. And you put this excavated soil on top of this domed roof, and you pounded it down with the back of a shovel. And it had to be at least 14 inches thick. Now, there was concern that German bombers flying overhead would look down and see newly overturned soil that wasn't populated by plants and say, ah, there's a family in there, and try to do direct hits on these shelters where people were spending, in many cases, the whole night sleeping in these shelters. So the English began growing plants as quickly as they could on the shelters. A favorite plant to grow was any sort of squash. The English call them marrows, but you know, the equivalent of like our butternut squash, because you plant those seeds and those things grow, and they will create a natural vine covering, basically natural camouflage right over the Anderson shelter. Now, many of the people who were spending those nights in the shelters were women, sometimes lone women, women with their elderly parents. Sometimes, you know, people did have some children in the city, so you might have had women with their children. Not too many men were in those shelters because most of them were at war. And obviously, the tension associated with this, if anyone has seen the movie Mrs. Miniver and the night that the Miniver family spends in the Anderson shelter, gives you a pretty good idea of what it was like. Truly, truly frightening. A lot of those women were self-medicating with the herb valerian, and that is what got them through those nights. And a lot of those, of course, they had victory gardens in England as well, but a lot of those early victory gardens, one corner of the garden was given over to valerian. And valerian grows very well. It's almost a weedy plant. I like to think that some of it was actually creeping up on the Anderson shelters. Some women would, you know, make a tea out of it, and they would drink that. And then there were a number of different nerve tonics and capsules available on the market, some of which contained valerian as well. And so, you know, that might not have been an absolutely essential plant for health, but it certainly was an important plant when it comes to mental health and nerves.
Yeah, wow. Fascinating.
And, of course, you know, you can go into an herbalist now, and, you know, valerian is still sold and still used.
Yeah, we use that quite often, yeah, with passion flower and some other things, too.
And I understand it's used with animals as well. I spoke to a group of veterinarians who practice alternate medicine, actually up at Niagara Falls early last spring, and they mentioned that many of the dogs who are terrified of thunder do quite well on valerian, so I thought that was interesting.
So there were these shortages. What about antimicrobials? there was a big shortage of those things.
Well, antimicrobials. Well, of course, you know, garlic has a long history in wartime. Garlic was used as a medicinal dressing in World War I, and I think maybe in some remote areas, I think maybe in France, even in World War II. I have got to run that down a little bit more.
Yeah.
Sphagnum moss also. We think of it as peat moss because people buy it in shrink-wrapped cubes or rectangular solids for their gardens. But when that is alive and growing, it's a green moss that colonizes bogs, and it's extremely acidic. And that also has been used as an antimicrobial dressing because it simply inhibits the growth of most bacteria because the pH, the acidity level is so low, and the acidity level is so high and the pH is so low.
Yeah.
The lower the pH, the more acid it has. And so those are certainly two options. And, of course, by the middle of the war, penicillin had come online. Penicillin is actually a fungus. One of the main plants that it infects is actually citrus crops. It grows on oranges. And penicillin was really a boon because deep wounds could be treated with penicillin. And people lived who might have died in the past from infected wounds. I think one of the most interesting military uses of plants involves scopalamine. Scopalamine is one of the so-called tropane alkaloids that occurs in several members of the potato and tomato family. It's a big family called the Solanaceae. And it's one of these supermarket families. You know, you go to the produce section of your supermarket, potatoes, white potatoes, tomatoes, eggplant, these are all in the Solanaceae. But then the family has sort of a nefarious side.
Yeah.
Henbane, Solandra.
Stramonium.
Stramonium, absolutely. Azatura, yeah. Brugmansia. Yeah. Some of the plants that are used by shamans for divination.
Right.
And those tend to be the ones that have these tropane alkaloids. So the U.S. used the tropane alkaloids. When we captured the crews of German U-boats and we wanted them to tell us what they knew about strategy and plans and what was going on from a German perspective, we dosed them with scopalamine to get them to talk. It's a truth serum. And the Germans did the same to American and English troops that they captured. But here is, I think, a very interesting use of scopalamine. The Germans actually developed a medicinal mixture that they called ZEE, S-E-E. And it consisted of some opiates, for pain relief, some ephedrine, which I think, now you could probably comment more on this than I can. Would that constrict blood vessels and prevent bleeding out, perhaps?
Yeah.
And then the third ingredient was scopalamine.
Mm.
And this mixture, S-E-E, in German it's pronounced ZEE, was used to treat men who had been severely injured on the battlefield.
Wow.
So German medics would rush out there and dose these guys with ZEE. Now, what was the effect? Well, the ephedrine had a medical effect, constriction. The opiates relieved pain, and the scopalamine made them forget the experience. Because what the Nazi government needed these guys to do was heal and return to battle. And that's what they used it for.
It's a very ancient formula because it was used even as a surgical formula by the great Ayurvedic surgeon Sushruta. And it's probably was first published in the Vedas.
Uh-huh.
Judith, so if you go back and look at some of the ancient history, find that they combined they actually used some hemp, too, by the way, in there.
Uh-huh.
That was the famous blend of the Ayurvedic surgeons, opiates, scopolamine, and hemp for pain relief.
That is very interesting. I am going to run that down because that would be an important connection to make.
Sure,
now,
yeah.
Now, another time that you saw this was in the 1920s, again, in Germany. After World War II, the population took a big drop. If you look at population growth in Germany, it fell off precipitously during World War I and after World War I. And then, of course, they lost a lot of men.
Oh, yeah.
The advent of the Nazis, they wanted to see that population begin to grow. And so there was a team of doctors in Freiburg who, again, used this method, basically opiates and scopolamine, to give to women who were undergoing childbirth. Mm. And, you know, we all know, those of us who are mothers know, childbirth can be painful. And they called the method the Freiburg method. It became known as twilight sleep.
Yes.
A woman would be dosed with this stuff at regular intervals during the hours that she was in labor. And the idea was that she would just drift through labor. It would be painless. Did it really work? Well, I think there was still pain, but the scopolamine made the women forget the pain.
I think if you were born around, but before 1960, your mom probably had that.
It was very common.
Yeah, my mom did, definitely.
Yeah, it was very common. I had a neighbor several years ago, a lovely woman, who had four of her five children using twilight sleep. Mm-hmm. And she said, you know, it certainly was not what it was built up to be. What you had was odd hallucinations. And you knew that you still were undergoing labor, but you were hallucinating simultaneously. And she wasn't a fan.
Yeah.
But when this first came to light during the 20s, I mean, it was just advertised as a godsend for women. And it quickly moved from Germany across the ocean to the U.S., and doctors were using it, and there were special hospitals where you could go and have this. But then gradually, the flip side of it became known. And there were women who were hallucinating so badly that they were jumping out of bed, and some of them actually got onto fire escapes thinking they could fly and tried to jump.
Yes.
Hospitals were having to redesign hospital gowns for patients and have stitching across the bottom of the armhole so that women could not claw at themselves. So basically it was a blunt hand so that you couldn't tear it yourself. The last hospitals in the U.S. that used it was actually as late as the 1960s, and they tended to be hospitals that treated impoverished women. The women would come in, they'd get knocked out with twilight sleep, and they'd get the baby. So it's one of these things that it was women's culture and the women's movement that promoted it, and it was women's culture and women's movement at the end in the 60s that dismantled it and ended it.
Yeah.
So it's one of those practices went on for almost half a century. But here's the ironic thing. I think a lot of the young men who are being treated with this drug mixture on the battlefields in Europe were themselves born with the same drug. I think their mothers were widespread using the Freiburg method. Hitler wanted women to have babies. I mean, if you were a woman and you could pump out infants, you had special privileges. You got extra food packages. You got awards. There were special awards of honor for highly productive women. He needed soldiers. One of his big reasons for waging the war was that he maintained that Germans had a cultural and a genetic right to farm, and he wanted a Lebensraum, room for living. And if you're going to occupy other areas of Europe, and I think eventually he thought he'd occupy at least half of the U.S., you need people. You need good Germans who are going to be willing to go out there and farm, and somebody's got to bear those children. Mm-hmm. And so there were childbirth was definitely incentivized at that point, And that was the goal. That was the goal, to really build up the German population so that you could build up farming and agriculture and move forward from there.
Wow. So we're going to take a quick break, Judith.
Okay.
We're here with Judith Sumner, and she's a specialist in ethnobotany, flowering plants, garden history, fabulous lecturer, and telling history of herbal medicine, you know, like it's a fabulous story, which it is, of course. And I'm really pleased to have her on, being certainly a history buff myself. On today's show, we're discussing Plants Go to War, a botanical history of World War II. And so we're going to take a break and play the Natural Medicine Chest and come back with some more interesting information. Stay with us, folks.
On this edition of the Natural Medicine Chest, we'll talk about high blood pressure or hypertension.
Hypertension or high blood pressure is a disease of the Western world and a product of modern civilization. Cultures that continue to adhere to an indigenous lifestyle, which includes low stress levels, a non-refined whole foods diet, as well as vigorous exercise, experience virtually no episodes of essential hypertension. It is very interesting to note that when individuals from these societies emigrate to Western countries and adopt Western habits, they too fall prey to hypertension. Naturopathic treatment of hypertension has not changed essentially in the last century. The mainstay of the treatment still relies on diet, exercise, stress reduction, lifestyle modification, with secondary support from other modalities such as hypotensive phytotherapy or herbal medicine, hydrotherapy, which is the therapeutic use of water, clinical nutrition, as well as homeopathy. We'll focus on phytotherapy in this edition of the Natural Medicine Chest.
Let's talk about Taraxacum officinalis. This is an unpopular nuisance to many homeowners trying to build that perfect lawn. However, this common weed, the dandelion, is a powerful yet safe botanical medicine for the treatment of hypertension. In a Romania study in 1974, the common dandelion was found to be as potent a diuretic as a commonly used drug called Lasix. Dandelion, however, due to its rich levels of potassium, acted against potassium ion depletion, a dangerous condition known as hypokalemia, seen as a side effect of many antihypertensive drugs which promote diuresis. The leaf of the dandelion was a more effective medicine than the root, although the root is utilized by naturopathic physicians and has a powerful liver-specific medicinal quality.
Crataegus oxycantha, also known in the vernacular as hawthorn, is a common tree in the family Rosaceae, or the rose family. Extracts of the plant in the Western literature date back far beyond the Middle Ages. Even the Chinese were privy to its usage, especially as a digestive tonic. The therapeutic principles are found in extracts from the leaves, berry-like fruits, as well as the flowers. In Europe, Crataegus is well respected for its effects at lowering blood pressure, blood lipids, reducing angina attacks, and preventing and perhaps reversing atherosclerotic deposition in arterial walls. This plant has demonstrated a remarkable safety record, but because of its powerful effects, it should not be used with certain cardiac or hypotensive drugs and should be used by a qualified practitioner of alternative medicine.
Other herbs are also helpful for hypertension, such as garlic, olive, and olive oil, and ginkgo biloba.
So if the pressures of life are making your blood boil, don't forget about these herbal medicines the next time you reach into the Natural Medicine Chest.
Okay. And that brings us back to our program, Plants Go to War, a botanical history of World War II, a look at military history from a botanical perspective. So we're here with Judith, and welcome back.
Thank you.
What about on the Pacific front? I remember reading in some of my work that part of the reason why we were invading some of the Japanese islands was to secure some quinine because of the malaria that was affecting the GIs. Remember, my grandfather even developed malaria. He was stationed in New Guinea, way in the jungles of New Guinea. Mm. And so I know some of the before they were able to synthesize quinine. You know, for those who don't know, quinine was used for the treatment of malaria, which was affecting, I guess, some of the GIs in the Pacific front. And part of the quest was to find places where quinine grew. And I know they tried growing it in Jamaica because, you know, I've done a lot of work in the island there. And up in the highlands, they tried to figure out what was the climactic and solar requirements of quinine and the altitude requirements. And they tried to emulate it by growing them in the highlands in the Blue Mountains of Jamaica. It became a national park called Chincona National Park, but eventually they found that it would not thrive in Jamaica. It just wasn't the same as the Andes or the Pacific, Java, and areas where quinine was grown there. Not sure if you came across any of that in your research.
Well, the quinine story is very interesting. Of course, malaria is caused by a little protozoan-like creature that actually lives in mosquitoes. And if a mosquito bites you and you get injected by the salivary gland, you can get malaria. Mm-hmm. The little organism is a plasmodium. And to get rid of the plasmodium, you need some drug. And the original plant was known as fever bark, and it is the genus Cinchona. It was first discovered in Western medicine by Jesuit priests who were living in South America.
Mm-hmm.
And they began telling others about it. People began using it in the continental U.S. when it became available. And we don't think as, you know, with the eastern seaboard of the U.S. as being an area with malaria. But it was. Anywhere where you had undrained swamps, what is now Washington, D.C., was the center of malaria. And it's a miserable disease. And you can actually end up with it for life. And it is particularly hard on children and the elderly and expectant mothers. If you are in any way compromised, it can kill you. So, soldiers during World War II did encounter malaria in tropical areas, particularly some of these tropical islands. And even today, if you're going off to botanize, for instance, in New Guinea, in Papua New Guinea, you do have to start taking anti-malarial drugs weeks before you leave, before you depart. Malaria, or quinine, did cause some troubles during World War II. And it ultimately was replaced by a synthetic drug called atabrine, because getting the trees, getting the cinchona bark, and purifying the quinine, we just could not do it at the level at which we needed it to supply men who were in the Pacific theater of war. Atabrine had some side effects. It did turn you yellow.
Mm.
I think some men had stomach troubles while they were on atabrine as well. Now, this isn't to say that chemists and botanists did not continue to work on quinine. In fact, Robert Woodward, a chemist who was actually a dear friend of my late father, who was also a chemist, Bob Woodward synthesized quinine during the war, so he could actually make synthetic quinine in the laboratory and not have to go and actually obtain it from cinchona bark. But we stuck with atabrine for the duration. Of course, now the problem with quinine and chloroquinine and a number of these synthetic and the substitute versions of it are that plasmodium, tiny little organism, can just evolve very quickly and can develop immunity to quinine within years. And so something besides quinine has to be found. And, for instance, in China right now, in some areas, they're using artemisia. And what they find is that using the whole herb, rather than just pulling out specific chemical constituents, so rather than pulling out artemisinin, use the whole herb, grind the whole thing up, and dry it, put it in a capsule, and take one of those each day. And some people use artemisia tea, which is, you know, basically the the chemical equivalent. And that really does help to keep malaria at bay. But malaria is definitely a challenge in the Pacific.
Yeah. The 2015 Nobel Prize in Medicine was won by a physician who discovered malaria, Yo-Yo Tu. So it's amazing that, and she, of course, was the first one to isolate the artemisian from the artemisia, mm-hmm. which is another. Now that's an easy plant to grow around New England and across the continental U.S. and really across the world. It seems to be a noxious weed. We have to find uses for our weeds. I guess there's no such thing as a weed. A weed is a plant in the wrong place at the wrong time.
I like that definition so much.
Yeah,
a weed is a horticultural construct. It's something that a plant grower, typically a gardener, does not want in that location.
Right.
But there's no such thing as a bad plant. Every plant has some interest and some use. I really do believe that.
Yeah. Now, you were saying something about some of the other plants that were used. You talked about coal. Now, coal, of course, is from ancient plants and dinosaurs.
Yeah, coal is the fossilized remains of forests from the Carboniferous period, epoch, actually, if any geologists are listening. And we think of these coal forests as having giant ferns, tree ferns, huge lycopod-like organisms, which oddly, although they were the size of trees, probably did not have the texture of trees. They weren't really woody. Mm. They were really soft. They were pithy, almost more like celery in their texture. Mm. So some botanists have commented you probably could have walked up to one of these if there were humans alive at the time, which there were not, but theoretically, you could have walked up to one of them and taken your fist and just pushed it right through the trunk of the tree. Because it was just sort of a juicy, sort of pithy type of cellular material. But anyway, when these trees in these Carboniferous coal forests collapsed, you know, because they died, they went in the water. Many of them did not decay because they sort of fell into a semi-acidic swamp. They became fossilized, and this is what today we call coal. In fact, when coal is mined, it is not uncommon to find the fossilized leaf impressions of ferns and lycopods. And
those particular trees there, yeah.
Yeah, so you can actually see the remains. Now, coal was extremely important, especially in Europe during World War II. This is what they were using to heat, to fuel. They even retrofitted cars to burn coal. When they didn't have enough gasoline, they had coal-burning cars and coal-burning trucks. It was so important in England that they actually recruited and then ultimately drafted men to go into the coal mines. And it wasn't negotiable. If you got drafted to go to the coal mine, you're going to go to the coal mine. And many of those coal miners were forced to keep working as essentially conscripted coal miners for several years after the war. They were being sent underground to dig coal. It was that important to the English economy. Because remember, in England, there is no petroleum, really, and so anything like that was being imported. And there's very little wood. Most of England had been denuded of its forests, probably during the Middle Ages. Trees had been cut down for fuel.
And what about rubber, Judith? Because I know rubber comes originally from a tree, and now
rubber,
it's synthesized.
Rubber actually occurs in many plants, and one I'll just mention parenthetically is the one we just had on our little break there, Taraxacum officinale, the common dandelion. If any of your listeners ever removes a dandelion from your lawn and you notice you get a white exudate, sort of a white liquid on your fingers, if you rub that, within a few seconds, you'll get little rolls of true latex, and it pulls right out of solution, and that's true latex. In fact, dandelion was one of the alternative sources for rubber.
Really?
That was investigated during the war. We were looking, in the U.S.,
Didn't
we were looking
that.
For just about any plant that made rubber,
Wow.
You were a candidate for possible cultivation. Now, natural rubber, the actual tree, is Hevea brasiliensis.
Okay.
Many people know it now. They may not realize they know it, but they know it because a lot of furniture is made of rubber wood now. It's a very dense, heavy wood that grows quickly. And, you know, if you buy furniture that's not super-duper expensive, it might well be made of rubber wood.
Huh.
But we were certainly going down into South America, down into the Amazon, and trying to bring back rubber trees and plant them in alternate locations. And we were investigating other sources of rubber. And as with so many things, as with quinine, we ultimately turned to synthetic rubber, synthetic sources of rubber that could be made from butyl alcohol, because it was just so much easier to make the huge quantities of rubber that was needed during the war by doing it synthetically. But the original chemistry was derived from plants.
But the war kind of, you know, helped science, really. I'm trying to think of the word. It just accelerated science towards these discoveries and things like that.
Dr. Definitely. Z, that is the most... That is the most truthful thing. I mean, absolutely. You look at any branch of plant science, it was kicked forward in some way during the war.
Wow.
It's just amazing. Agriculture. You know, I would say in the U.S., we took, I would say, just a very laissez-faire attitude toward productivity before the war. You know, we went through the era of the Dust Bowl. During the Dust Bowl, you had... prolonged drought in the American Middle West. There were incredible dust storms, high winds, which then picked up particles of powdered soil and blew them all over. It was impossible to do agriculture normally. But, you know, we lived through it because we had enough farmland in this country that even though the Midwest was a dust bowl, we were okay.
Yeah,
and we had county agents going out and telling people, look, you need to do contour plowing, you need to use hybrid seed, you need to figure out ways to irrigate. And a lot of them just didn't do it. Very laissez-faire attitude. Well, let me tell you, once the war started, that was over, and you know we had to feed ourselves, we had to feed the military, and something that has almost been dropped out of history right now is the Lend-Lease program. We were feeding other countries. England, Russia, we were shipping huge amounts of food abroad well before the war ever started. As I mentioned before, the English were importing about two-thirds of their food. They found themselves in a real predicament because the Germans surrounded England, which is an island, with submachines, their U-boats, and it was a blockade. Hitler's plan was to starve out the English. We'll starve them out, you know, and then they'll have to do what we say.
Right.
We'll occupy them, and then they'll be basically annexed to Germany. So we started sending over a lot of food to England. You know, we sent over big ships. We grew the food here. A lot of it was dehydrated. So you could packet a large amount in to a small mass, and then the dehydrated food arrived over there. And they could just rehydrate it and eat it. So we were doing all of that, and so we had to have efficient agriculture. And so we see the first synthetic fertilizers coming online. You know, people now look, you know, might say, well, you know, my garden is all organic. I don't use any synthetic fertilizers, and that's nice, you know. And I tried to have my small vegetable garden at home be all organic and fertilize using my compost pile. But when survival is at stake, you know, sometimes we have to compromise a bit. And that is exactly what happened during World War II. Had to use synthetic fertilizers. And the key to the whole process of making them involved taking nitrogen, just N2, nitrogen gas from the atmosphere, and so chemically speaking, grabbing it and attaching hydrogens to it. And it's a process called nitrification, and it yields ammonia. And then ammonia could be incorporated as a mineral salt into fertilizers.
All
it's
right.
also extremely explosive. And
yeah.
so some of these, some of the nitrified products, the ammonia, was used in making bombs as well, used in making ordnance material. But it's a process called the Haber process, H-A-B-E-R. It was invented by a German chemist named Fritz Haber. And the history of chemistry, the guy has two sides. He also developed the process of making synthetic mustard gases. You go back to the men who were gassed during World War I, including my own grandfather, many of whom were blinded permanently or temporarily and who continued to have effects years after the war. The process of making synthetic mustard gases was also the work of Haber. But then I guess he improved his reputation by coming up with the nitrification process known as the Haber process. I might add that mustard gases also do have a botanical root. They are patterned after the mustard oils that actually do occur in the mustard family, and they are strong blistering agents. So anyone who's ever heard of, for instance, a mustard plaster or a poultice made of horseradish, that is essentially what the mustard oils were, but just imagine having really concentrated amounts sprayed in your eye or aerosol mist, and you breathe this down, and it's just the effects of
That's why they call it wasabi, because when you take the wasabi, the steam comes out of your ears and you yell wasabi. That's
yes.
a joke. A little botanical joke, but no, those are powerful, those isothiocyanate glycosides.
Right, they're sulfurous compounds, and
yeah.
they're strong blistering agents.
Yeah.
They were first used by the Germans against soldiers who were bivouacked at Ypres in France. And the canisters came over, the shells came over, and they were each marked with a yellow cross painted on. And so the mustard oil became known during World War II as Yellow Cross, also known as Ypres-ite. And at first there were no side effects. You know, the canisters broke and the stuff vaporized, and you know, the guys are looking at each other. And no side effects, but then, you know, within a couple of hours, they start to see the blistering in their eyes and in their throats and in their lungs. And absolutely terrible.
Yeah,
probably many
yeah.
of your listeners have seen the John Singer Sargent painting, which is actually at the Imperial War Museum in London. And it's a gigantic mural, huge rectangular mural of men, many of whom have been blinded temporarily or permanently by mustard gas. Eyes are bound up, and they're leading each other out of the forest. But yes,
terrible.
Absolutely terrible. My late maternal grandfather was gassed with mustard gas during World War I. Mm. He was a career army. He was a general in the U.S. Army. In World War II, he was really too old to fight, but he was there. He was in Europe. And he ended up at one point in Italy, and he ventured into a village where they were starving. There was simply not enough flour to make pasta or make bread. And the local bakers were taking anything they could get to extend the flour. If it was powdered and white, they'd mix it in. So they were taking marble dust. And it looked like flour, and they were tossing it in with the flour.
Wow.
They were taking finely milled sawdust and throwing that in with the flour. Some sawdust may have some nutritional value, especially if it incorporates the outermost layers of the tree, so you get the bark and you get the food-conducting tissue, the phloem, which is right below the bark. You might get some nutritional value, but if you're just taking the core of the tree, no, because humans don't have the enzymes to break down
sawdust. Right.
And then the marble dust, I mean, that's self-evident. I mean, the bread must have landed in their stomachs like a rock, because it's a rock.
It is.
So these people were desperate, And he spoke to a woman who lived in a large manor house, and she said, you know, if there's anything you can do, what can we do? And he got them U.S. Army flour, and she gave him two quite large candlesticks that have roses molded in them of iron to bring home as a thank you.
Wow. Fascinating. Well, unfortunately, we've run out of time, so we wanted to share anything you wanted to for the listeners if they want to get in contact with you or find out more about your lectures and writings and other things.
Well,
like
I do
that.
Have a website.
Go ahead.
And it's Judith Sumner, www.judithsumner, JudithSumner.com. And on the website, you'll find out more about me and the talks that I give and some of the research I'm doing right now in the botany of World War II, Plants Go to War, and some about other books that I have written on medicinal plants and uses of medicinal plants in American homes.
Yeah, we want to have you back and talk about that, Judith, so we'll be in touch.
Okay.
And,
thank you so much.
Yeah, I love your, I just, you know, being a history buff myself, it was just great. I learned so much. Thank you so much. It was very entertaining and also super informative. Appreciate your sharing all that great information.
Well, thank you for inviting me, and I look
welcome.
Forward to speaking with you and your listeners again sometime.
Okay. Thanks,
okay.
Judith.
Very good.
Bye-bye. And that does it for another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Dr. Z signing out and hoping that you have a healthy day. Bye-bye.